I'm Clint Emerson, and welcome to Season 2 of Can You Survive This Podcast, where the interview is just as dangerous as the scenarios I put my guests through. From hostage situations to natural disasters, carjackings, active shooters, and more, if you're looking for the skills necessary to survive these situations, then this is the show for you. Hey, what's up, everyone? This is Clint, and thank you for listening to another episode of Can You Survive This Podcast? We are doing a compilation of the greatest hits, if you will, of the past. And we thought, hey, why not give you a taste of the best interviews you may have missed, the best survival stories and tips you may not have paid attention to last time? So hold on and get ready for Can You Survive This Podcast's greatest hits. Enjoy.
Yeah, I think you and I both are big believers in mastering the basics is what makes you advanced.
100%.
A lot of people think there's supposed to be some ninja tricks out there that we're not teaching them that we know. And I'm like, nope, you just got to master the basics.
And I know that you've talked about this Benghazi several times. So give the Cliff Notes version for those that if this is our first time to hear about Benghazi, what happened in your role, you know, give us a quick little that version you've probably said 1,000 times. I'm sorry to make you say it again.
It's not a problem. And it keeps the memories of Roan and Bubba alive as well.
Right. I agree. Which we'll dig into them too.
But I was with, like you said, GRS, Global Response Staff. That's the security operatives or agents or whatever the cool guy word you want to use, officers of the Central Intelligence Agency. And we were in Libya at that time, just doing what we usually do, which is protection, surveillance, counter surveillance, low profile protection, very low vis. And then also doing getting the layouts and the atmospherics of the city, which we would pass on daily. Now, unbeknownst to us until we really got there, our main objective there was to provide weapons and get weapons and move Saddam's weapons around that region. Legal or not, that's something that DC will have to explain, or they have tried to explain or not explain. When we were there that evening, it was an attack on the U.S. consulate. We were at the annex, which was about 3/4 mile away from the consulate. It was attacked. We responded to the attack. There were 6 of us, tremendous team. We had 2 Navy SEALs, 3 Marines, and myself as the Lone Ranger. Man, I was Tonto and the Lone Ranger at the same time. How about that? I didn't know.
That's pretty cool, actually.
We responded, and the attack was pulled off by Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb, AQIM, and then Ansar al-Sharia, which later melded into what we know as ISIS now. It was just a 13 hours of, and it wasn't continual. Any firefight where you're at it continually, it's just like a boxing match. There's punches and there's lulls, and there's punches and there's lulls. Right. And that's what it was. But we had 5 distinct separate firefights that night. The last one we didn't have the ability to counter it. It was with mortars. If we would have got the air support we asked for, I think we wouldn't have got mortared that evening. But the last attack, I think they were more inclined to like, hey, we're not going to try to get anybody, which is what they were initially trying to do, is just take somebody, trying to get a prisoner, a high value target, which the ambassador, Chris Stevens, was. And he was a huge target for him. When they found out that they were losing too many bodies and they just couldn't get that person, steal that person, use them as propaganda, primarily the ambassador who they were trying to get, they brought in the big guns, which we couldn't defend. And they dropped 81 millimeter mortars on us, which killed Roan and Bub and severely injured Dave Ubin, who was the U.S. State Department security officer, and Mark Osgeist, who was the Marine that was with us there. And then we were able to finally get out of there with the help of, and for those that don't know it, and it never came out in the movie, we didn't put it this way, but it's in Trey Gowdy's select committee report. That's where I found out about it. I didn't even know these guys, but these guys, the militia that came to help us, that I had to throw the little jumbo signed up to, they were Omar Gaddafi loyalists that came and rescued us and actually took out the mortar team. I know, isn't it ironic, isn't it? That's why we were there to overthrow Gaddafi, yet we were saved by Omar Gaddafi.
How much money were they paid?
I know they were paid a lot, a ton.
Oh, yeah.
But they also, you know, they also took out that mortar team for us, which why we didn't keep getting hit. And I didn't know it that night at the time. All I was like, God, thank God those mortars are stopped, because we wouldn't have been able to do anything else. They could have just turned our compound into dust if they'd wanted to, because they were fire for effect. They were right on target.
There was one guy we were going after, and we rehearsed for about a year on this one guy. And the TTPs I had developed, you know, this was my baby.
Right.
So I was very excited to see this tactic, technique, procedure in full play. And ended up that we did this hit broad daylight, 12:30 in the afternoon. So the key was to hide in broad daylight, basically, you know, because if you're being sneaky, you're going to look sneaky. Mm-hmm. But if you're just hiding in broad daylight, you know, nobody's really aware. And that's what we did with this one. So it was, you know, track suits, leather jackets, body odor, unshaven, this kind of shit. And we're setting up this ambushite with cars rolling by, and we were actually posing as people working, you know, it's like street workers, chipping ice and stuff like that. Nice. 'Cause when we went up on the ambushite, guys were doing that. They were chipping ice, and they thought we were relief. Well, damn, man, what a stroke of luck that was. So we just pulled them off the side, said, hey, go down here, smoke these cigarettes. And we just took their tools and kept chipping ice.
Nice.
And we're setting up this ambush site, and there's a lot going on. There's several moving pieces and parts. So we're blocking traffic a quarter mile down that way, a quarter mile this way. Meanwhile, our HVT, we're letting him through, but he doesn't know, you know, what's going on. And this came down to seconds, you know. So imagine planning this thing for a year, and it came down to literally like a window of plus or minus 2 seconds.
Damn.
And then 10 seconds prior to this guy coming through, a cop car rolls through. Now, we had devices on this bridge, you know, but it was very benign to the everyday person. Mm-hmm. And I'm peeking through the guardrail. I mean, just a slit of my eyeball, and I have a balaclava down over my face. And all I could see is just the cars and the drivers going through. All right, car, this is get the last one. All right, last car is coming through now, and it's a cop car. And he slows down. And he's checking out. He sees something is wrong. And we're going, oh, my God, this is a contingency we didn't plan for. This is going to scoot everything up.
Uh-huh.
And he kept driving. And I was like, holy crap.
Yeah.
But then so the hit went down real fast. It was up like a minute and 30 seconds after a year of planning. Right. So on target, about a minute and 30 seconds. Last minute, we brought a guy with us. An officer who had just been assigned, he just came across the hall, just been assigned to a Sabre squadron. And we were adamantly opposed to him doing this, but command wanted him to get some, you know, on the ground time. Mm-hmm. in the leadership mode. And adamantly opposed to it. Good guy. Nonetheless, he did not rehearse with us. And he was just spazzing out like crazy. The hit was just finishing, and he assaults the pin car. He assaults the pin vehicle.
Right.
Our guys, but he doesn't know it's our guys. He doesn't know because he wasn't part of the planning. And he's smashing the window and AR in the face. And they're going, "Hey, bro, we're one of you." So
yeah. Kurt Busch, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that introduction. I've checked a lot of boxes off, you know, in the NASCAR world, but I'm ready to check off these boxes here too.
When was the last time you got a ticket?
I got a ticket this June, and it was in North Carolina. I'm on a rally with a bunch of buddies, and I was running in the back. You know, I was just chilling back there. Yeah. And the cop pulls us all over. And we're doing 82 and a 70. I'm like, I'm like, this is going to be fine. You didn't see us 3 miles back, you know, when we were really gassing it up triple digits. And he goes and grabs everybody's license and then comes back to the back car, which is me. And he hands me my license and he says, "Hey, I need you to go up the road. I got too many people here on the side of the road. This is kind of a danger situation for all these people. I need you to go up ahead. I'm like, all right, cool. You know, I'm thinking I'm getting out of it. So I go up to the where he told me to go. It's the next gas station up. And there's another cop that's about a mile before that gas station. And the red and blue blip. And now they're behind me. And I'm like, man, I was just told to go to the gas station up ahead. So I pull in. They get out. I get out. And the junior police officer in the passenger seat wants a picture. Because it's North Carolina, NASCAR guy, and they wanted a picture, yeah. Right? So I take the picture. Everything's cool. And I still like haven't gotten my ticket yet. And hours later, everybody trickles in to this gas station. Like now I've had like 7 bags of Fritos, 7 Monsters. Like what's going on? And he hands out a ticket to everybody on the rally. Everybody got a ticket. And I'm like, wait a minute. I took a picture with these guys 3 hours ago. Now I was mad. And my buddy's like, just grabbed me by the back of my collar. Just get in the car. Let's go.
Yeah.
And now I got to send it to lawyers and they handled it. It was, you know, it was $300 ticket. Somebody's got to show up in court. But I'm like, wait a minute. I had to take a picture. I thought we're out of this. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
That so sounds it goes fair to both, me.
It goes both ways. It can go worse or it can get better. It just depends.
Yeah. Well, there you go. For all you law enforcement listening. Come on. Come on.
It's just be real. Just be real. Yeah.
Picture equals 0 tickets. Come on. All right. So we roll into, I think, the final one here. Kurt or Kyle? You put your money on yourself.
Sounds like we're done here, you know? You're talking to the faster one, the better one, and the more handsome one.
Yeah.
I love the rivalry that we've always had. A lot of people don't know, 7 years younger than I am. And so we didn't race against each other at all as kids. You know, I was over here, he's over there. And by the time he got to Cup, I had already mastered it. And so it took him 3 or 4 years to kind of catch up at the Cup level.
Yeah.
And then when he did, boom, it was on. Like, like we were like at each other for a while. So it's been good over the years. You know, we've kind of had all the ebbs and flows of who's going to be bigger, who's going to get more stats, who got us here, who had what imagery issue problems, you know, like we've gone through it all together. And
yeah,
at this point right now, like we both throw an arm around each other and go, dude, we've done it all.
Let's go through this. It's pretty good. Ritlin is credited for helping mainstream the Epstein didn't kill himself internet meme. At the end of an interview with Jesse Waters on Fox News, Ritlin asked if he could give a PSA. And I'm going to kind of paraphrase here. And you basically, at the end of answering one of the questions, you said, if you see the coverage about combat dogs and you decide you want one of these dogs, buy one fully trained and finished, or don't buy one at all. And Epstein didn't kill himself. So, now I know you've kind of told me the backstory to that, but, so what caused you to kind of throw that out there, and who would have thought it's the most Googleable thing about you?
Well, yeah, I mean, of all things to be remembered by, it's probably not at the top of my list of preference, but, you know, the weird thing about it is a couple things. One is that, I was just fucking with him, basically, is that I had done a number of interviews that week because it was on the heels of the ISIS Baghdadi raid where they sent a dog in on him and he clacked himself off before the dog got there. And so everybody wanted to know all about dogs. It was kind of like, post Bin Laden raid when they found out a dog was on it and everybody lost their shit over it. But, it was at the end of an interview where to me, it just felt like Jesse Waters was kind of scoffing at it. Like, it's a fucking dog. Like he just wasn't taking it that serious. At least that's how it felt to me. after I'd done like CNN and other big media outlets that were, you know, asking really good questions and were taking it pretty serious. It seemed like it was just kind of a joke to him and it was irritating. But on the way there, sitting in traffic, it was kind of right at the start where Joe Rogan had mentioned it before. And there were a few memes that were, you know, out that were just funny, but it wasn't like a huge thing yet. And so literally totally off the cuff, like I had planned on doing the PSA thing because so many people had reached out saying, oh, hey, I want a puppy. And, you know, the internet sales of fucking Malinois, you know, skyrocketed, you know, and that's bad for a number of reasons. But so I wanted to say that, to use that as an opportunity to tell people like, hey, it's a serious breed. Like if you don't have one that's totally finished and trained by a professional and they teach you how to handle the dog, you're asking for it. I've seen it too many times to know better. Mm-hmm. And then just at the end of it, I threw that in there, just kind of fucking with them. This was a pre-recorded segment. It was not live. And that's what most people, I think, didn't realize is that hats off to Fox News. They kept it in there. We recorded it on a Friday afternoon. And they aired it the following Saturday night. So it wasn't like a, you know, oh shit, hit the mute button. Like they kept it in there, you know? So, and for whatever reason, like that was just the weird right place, the right time, 15 minutes of fame catalyst that like people that I hadn't talked to in 25 years were like, dude, I just saw you on, you know, some other media outlet that was replaying it or, like a guy that I hadn't talked to in probably 10 years was like, dude, I'm sitting at a truck stop in North Dakota and the table behind me is playing your video over and over, laughing their asses off. Like just like these six grown men truckers, like laughing their ass off, you know, watching this video or whatever. So, yeah, I mean, totally unintended consequence thing. It was just a spur of the moment.
Yeah.
Talking with the guy thinking that it wouldn't even show up. And it did. And here we are now. That's, at the top of the list.
Yeah. Good job. Forget about all your dog work. Let's just, concentrate on Epstein here for, You're listening to Can You Survive This Podcast? Thanks for tuning in. Please make sure to subscribe, rate, and share on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite shows. Now we're going to turn it into a hypothetical crisis scenario for you. So are you ready to see if you can survive this podcast?
Ready as I'll ever be.
All right. Well, we've got a lot of these scenarios will kind of sound and start the same, but Jeff is good. Jeff, one of the producers, is good at mixing it up. So don't think for a second that you're about to listen or hear the same scenario. So here we go. As you round a corner, okay, you run straight into one of these bad guys, and now he's pointing a gun at your chest. Okay, so do you A, kick him in the nuts, or B, you want to basically trap, pivot, and strip the gun from him?
Well, I don't have the skill to trap and pivot the gun. I mean, for me, all I'm thinking right now is I just want that away from my chest, right, as best as I could possibly get it.
Yeah.
So I know that's not one of the options.
It kind of is. It kind of, because you're trapped. If you're going to grab the gun in any way, that's really trapping the gun. Yeah.
Right. I just want to get him. Like if I can get that weapon away, like I can't take a shot to the chest, but I can. You know, it's not going to kill me if it hits me in the arm,
right?
As we've seen from things that are going on right now in the media. So I just want to, you know, as long as I can get that gun away from my center mass or from my head or anything like that. That's what I do. I say when you kick him, because all the, you know, they might pull the trigger if I kick him in the nuts. It might go like that, you know.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, I think you process of elimination. You know, B is right, and you pivot and trap. You know, trapping the gun just means okay, I just got to get my hands on it. Number two, the pivot is what gets your body out of the way, so it's not pointed at you any longer. You can also drive it to the sky or drive it to the ground. You know, in these situations, there's no right or wrong. It's just come out alive is the goal.
As you round the corner, one of the assailants is pointing a gun at your chest. Okay. Do you A, kick him in the nuts, or B, basically trap the weapon? Okay. Pivot, trap, and grab it.
We're obviously within arm's reach.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. You never be in front of the little hole.
That's right. So B, you're going to kind of pivot your body out of the way of the barrel and trap the weapon with your hands the best you can. With the gun trapped, a struggle ensues. So do you A, yank forward to strip the gun away, or B, control it and drive the barrel towards the enemy's chest?
Can I back up for 1 second?
Sure.
The last second when Clint said, get your body out of the way and move the, and then trap the gun.
Yes.
just want to say to everybody, move your hands first as you're doing that.
Yeah.
Because your body will never move, but your hands will. So when you do that, hands and body,
because hands simultaneous. Will. Yeah. Yeah.
But if you stepped and then moved your hands, the guy will track with you if he means to shoot you. But B is the second answer. You want to drive in, you want to control that weapon and knock this fucker off balance.
That's right. Control and drive towards their chest. Or what also works is straight up, like just getting that gun offline and away from you is the ultimate goal. But maintaining control of the weapon is also your primary yeah. goal as well. And once you've got it, don't let it go.
With any of these active shooter situations, you know, the situation itself dictates what's the right or wrong. Mm-hmm. You know, but ultimately, you've got to know where the shooter is, because as you know, and I've discussed this before, gunshots fired indoors is super loud and it's omnidirectional. So you have a hard time knowing exactly where the shots are actually coming from. Sometimes Absolutely. They sound like they're coming from the right, but really they're coming for the left. But yeah,
if you looked at active shooter scenarios in schools and malls and stuff, a lot of times the groups of people were running right towards the dude because
exactly.
they heard gunshots and it reflected off the wall and they ran right into the actual shooter. So
yeah.
Very good point for sure.
Yeah. So freezing up is never a good idea in a survival situation. Stay low to the ground and finding cover gives you better chance of survival than freezing up and being an easy target. So you stay yep. low and you get moving. So next, do you A, get behind a large rack of food in order to hide from the shooter, or B, stay low, zigzag over to one of those freestanding meat coolers?
I'll go with the meat coolers. I'd probably have yeah. a little bit more, you know, cover there. And
right.
A better, you know, I would try to position myself to be in a dominant position over the shooter, and wherever he's positioned. You don't want to get up behind a soft cover in a scenario like that, because
right.
bullets go through bread quick.
Cover versus concealment, right? So bread, potato chips, any rack of food is not going to stop bullets, though it will hide you from the bad guy. Now cover is anything that stops bullets. So for those of you listening, you know, you always want to choose cover over concealment, because cover will still hide you, but it stops bullets. Like, you know, a freezer full of frozen meat will certainly stop some bullets, but the bread shelf will not. So cover versus concealment. Always yeah, look for
just
cover.
Just like your car, like a car door too. People forget you can yeah, shoot right hollow. Through a car door, yeah. man. Easy. So
yeah,
get behind that engine block, get behind
yeah.
The wheel well, you know, get behind something that's hardened, because people have a misconception of what bullets can do. They clean, a 9mm will cleanly go through a door of a car.
Sure will.
So yeah, that's something you got to think about when you're in that scenario for sure.
Suddenly a Molotov cocktail comes flying in through your open window. All right. And the mob wants to burn the building down. Do you A, run out of the building and sprint straight for the Honda, or B, do you zigzag your run, keeping your head low as you try to escape?
B.
Yes, this is correct. And zigzag. So it's important to note, when you zigzag or run sporadically, it forces shooters and bad guys to change their elevation and windage, especially with rifles, pistols, whatever, anything with sights or optics, which makes you a harder target to hit. And that's the goal. Be a hard target. So with all the active shooting, mass shootings going on, you know, and you've got to run a long stretch of terrain and you don't have any cover to run to, and you find yourself in the open, run sporadically, run like an idiot, moving all over the place. It makes it a lot more difficult for the shooter to get accurate bullets in your back. You know, with all the reading I've done and actually talking and interviewing lots of people, there is this, like, you know, the bear encounter experience. It has been vastly different for a lot of different people. But the baseline that you hear all the time with black bears is to get loud, get big, because they are the least aggressive and you can actually scare them off. Like they're like a big rat, basically. Yeah. So you are right. Get loud, get big. And brown bear, like you said, are far more aggressive, so they say. But some of the techniques for both have worked with both. Mm. And it's important to say that. It's really the situation, the environment, in whether you are injured or not, and what's around you determines really what you're going to do. Give the other variation with black bears.
So black bears are often, as long as they're not like emaciated or injured, are much more afraid of us than we are of them.
Yeah.
Two is if we're 70 feet away, their eyesight isn't that great, but their sense of smell and their sense of hearing is pretty good. So chances are they heard me rather than see me. And so I don't want to target identify myself unless I absolutely have to. Likelihood is that bear is going to look over to see if I'm a threat, and then it's going to look down. And as soon as it looks away, I'm going to start retreating some more. But to your point, if that bear noticed me and started coming towards me, then I would go option A and make myself as big and as prominent and as fearsome as I could.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. 100%. They're like dogs. They can smell three-dimensionally, and with that good hearing, they know exactly where you are.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah. You can be behind a tree and they're still going to know you're behind a tree.
But there's a big difference between a bear, like, you know, feeding, just going,
Right.
And like making an overt turn towards you.
Without a doubt. And I would say too, the situation, if you've got your family with you versus you're by yourself, or with a mama bear with her cubs or by herself, also play a big role in the decision making process.
Huge.
You're home alone, okay? And you're in bed and suddenly everything starts to shake violently. All right. And I don't know if you're familiar with what California is due. It's actually overdue for a huge earthquake. So anyway, you feel everything start to shake, okay? Do you A, get up and rush out of the home, or B, stay in the house? Now, there's a lot of protocols that come with earthquakes that you may or may not know about, but you're going to A, get up and run outside, or are you B, going to stay inside?
Depends how violent the shake is. I would say that the first initial shake, I'd probably stay put. So, you know, I'd stay put, assess it, and then go from there.
There you go. Look at you. So, yes, you want to stay in the house. There's a lot of common misconceptions when dealing with earthquakes and the protocol that come with it. But rushing outside, especially at night, you know, you don't know what you're running into. And the structure you're inside of is going to protect you more than probably whatever's falling outside. You don't want to put yourself at risk, especially at night. So good job. Yes, B, stay in the house. All right, next. Do you A, lay down next to a sturdy piece of furniture, like a big couch or a table, or B, go stand in a door frame? It's a tough one.
I would say A, because if anything was to fall, then that sturdy bit of furniture would hopefully protect you from any.
Good job. Yes. A. Another misconception, because you'll hear about it here in the States, is go stand in a door frame. But unfortunately, door frames are not like reinforced. They're just a door frame. And there's nothing that's really going to protect you. But a couch laying like, you know, horizontally up against it will hopefully break the fall of other debris, because the number one killer in an earthquake is falling debris. So you want to basically take cover, if you will. So the shark is getting closer. So do you A, Donkey Kong style hammer fist the shark in the fin, or B, just do a hard or as hard as you can throw a punch in the water to its nose?
This is turning into a pretty bad day.
yeah, it started out okay. I mean,
definitely the nose.
Yeah, they say that nose is super sensitive, right? It's like the housing for radar, and it's not really a nose. It's like just the front, that front area. Just like humans, you know, anytime you mess with anybody's ability to breathe, it tends to make them to not want to be an aggressor any longer, right? So if you start to choke someone out, they panic and just don't want to be part of the situation any longer. With a shark, they have gills. They're a fish. And so if you can, if it gets getting close enough or it's even got a hold of you, getting your hands inside those gills and trying to rip them certainly can work to your advantage as well.
If you put the U.S. Embassy in the equation, I'm going to say move to the embassy. The embassy is your safe haven. That is where you can, that is where you can finally take a breath and relax. And actually, once you get inside safe haven, I mean, you know, you've got everything at your disposal at that point. You know, as an American citizen, what I think a lot of people don't realize, they don't value, is when they travel, not knowing where your embassies are, not knowing how to get to even a consulate, not knowing where the consulates are, not knowing how to get there, you know, in dire straits. So even though I would like to fly, Australia is a big ass continent and that little Cessna isn't going to get me very far, you know? So I'm going to just keep, I'm going to keep the goodwill rolling with this Honda, keep that goodwill rolling and get right to the embassy as quick as I can.
If those are the two options, God, see, I'm going to die, dude. I'm going to wrestle the gun away. I'm not getting the fucking car.
Well, that'd be very Texas of you for sure. But, you know, when you're outgunned, outnumbered, or taking severe blows of the head, sometimes you have to temporarily surrender to take control of the situation so you can escape.
I think that I would get in the car. I mean, I'm putting myself in that perspective. I would get in the car because, I mean, you know, that's you know, otherwise I'm getting shot. But, yeah, you talk tough, but I'd get in the car.
Yeah. I mean, it's, can you take control of a person with a gun even though you don't have anything? Yes. And I think a lot of people underestimate their capabilities, and they see a person with a gun and immediately go, he's got the advantage or she's got the advantage. Mm-hmm. I can't do anything. I might as well just sit here. I might as well do nothing. I agree. You could fight, but you take a chance of, you know, taking a round in the gut or in the head or in the chest. And or if you know what you're doing, you really think it through, you can take advantage of these guys, give in temporarily, and so that you can set yourself up for a clean escape later. So, but once again, if you're outgunned, which you are, outnumbered, or taking severe blows to the head, that temporary surrender is always a good option. And the reason I say that, especially severe blows to the head, the last thing you want to do is get knocked out and then wake up chained to a wall in a place you have no idea where you're at. Older model cars, you used to be able to kick out like the entire brake light, and then you could stick your arm out and actually wave, right? And people could see an arm hanging out. Now, these days with these newer cars, it's pretty much closed up. The frame is right there, but you can pull the wiring harness, you know, and totally kill the brake light so that hopefully a cop sees that or someone sees that and reports it. So, yeah, you got to get creative in the trunk for sure. And if any of you out there want to practice 180s, I mean, there's a couple of tricks to this. To a reverse 180 is literally you put it in reverse and you're going to look back into the direction in which you want to go. And you're going to give it gas and then you're going to run that steering wheel all the way around so that you can flip that hood 180 degrees with your ass towards the angry mob. And in the middle of all that, whether it's a stick or whether it's an automatic, you got to shift from reverse into neutral so that it glides and then into drive once your nose is forward. So reverse 180s, they take some practice, but they're actually pretty easy and effective, and you can usually do it. If you do it properly and get good, you can do it in one lane of space, believe it or not. And so the other takeaway with that, if you're going to go practice this in a parking lot near you, make sure all your tires are aired up approximately 5 PSI over max. It's important that those tires are hard as a rock and 100% fixated to that wheel rim, because if you roll the tire...
if you roll the tire over the rim, well, now you got flat tires and you are shit out of luck.
But generally speaking, it's important to see the pattern before jumping to conclusions, right? So if you look around and really take in the environment and you see that moss growth on one side of the tree and not the other, then it's telling you something about sunlight, right? And that's really the goal. Knowing, you know, rises in the east and sets in the west. And, you know, we know that the southern side of most, whether it's a building or a forest, right, it's going to get the most sun. You know, and we're still talking about the northern hemisphere. And it's those factors is what allows you to generally say that, okay, south, moss equals north, mm-hmm. right?
Okay.
Okay. So now that you've been heading north for a while, according to the moss compass, you're getting thirsty and you happen to come across a stream, all right? So do you A, bend down and drink from the stream, or B, dig a hole near the water's edge instead?
Where am I?
You are, you basically found a stream.
Okay.
You're heading north, and you can either drink directly from the water in the stream or maybe dig a hole at the edge of the stream.
I'm going to dig. I hate to say I broke this every single day in Alaska, but I felt a little safer way up there. But I'm going dig.
I mean, you are at the top of the stream up there. I mean, right? I mean, by the time you're in like Canada or even Colorado, a lot of stuff is peed in the water by the time it gets mm-hmm. to those points.
It is 80% right. urine at that point.
Yeah, so I think when you're in the Arctic, it's safe to say that, you know, it's probably pretty safe water to drink. Now you're enjoying your coffee before you leave when you notice a real dodgy looking fellow looking at you and looking at other patrons on the patio, right? So he's kind of scoping some things out. This guy does not look like he belongs there. He's not ordering anything to drink. He's just kind of hanging out looking sketchy. So do you, A, avoid looking at him, drink your coffee, and look at your phone as to not look at the guy and draw any attention to yourself, right? Or B, keep your eyes on him without making it too obvious?
Yeah, I'd definitely be watching him.
Yeah. Keep your eyes on him.
Eye contact, yeah.
I agree. We actually just had like Spencer Corson, who, you know, he's a safety kind of security guy who also works in crisis management. And he had a client who was in this exact scenario where she just kind of ignored the problem. And guess what? The problem became her problem because he thought, oh, yeah, I'm just going to take advantage of the one who's not paying attention to me.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So
they like to prey on the people who seem weak or vulnerable and not paying attention. So, I mean, I've even had times when people will, like, if you run past me once or like whatever, like I'll notice you. If you run past me twice, I think like, okay, maybe they forgot something or maybe like whatever. If you run past me a third time, I'm literally watching you until I don't see you again. So they know that I know exactly who you are and what you look like.
Right. No, I think that's good. And in the world of surveillance, which is where I played for a while, you know, you had rules that you never drive past the target more than once, right? When you're doing a CTR, which is a close target reconnaissance. And it's for that reason, because twice, it's kind of like a magic trick. Once is knowledge, or once is magic, twice is knowledge, right? And mm-hmm. so you want to keep everything you do kind of like a magic trick. You only want to really do it once. But on the receiving end, you definitely should be looking for those multiple passes in any of those other signs and symptoms that someone's targeting you. We will be right back after the break. You start to open the driver's door to get into your vehicle, and one of the guys pushes the driver's door shut and says, "Empty your pockets." So do you A, draw your weapon, or B, try to reason with them and ask them that, hey, I don't want any trouble?
First off, I would try and create space at this point. Probably not going to deploy a pistol at this point because I would rather give them money than shoot them. And you haven't said whether or not they've produced any weapons yet. So I'm assuming that they haven't. They're asking for money. So I'm going to try and comply with them, right? I'm going to, you know, continue to engage verbally, but I'm definitely not going to get in the car at this point because you get crushed getting in the car right there. And I'm going to be circling to try and make sure that I'm lining up both of their guys, right? You can't get flanked. So it becomes a movement game at this point to make sure that you are, that you're tracking on both of the threats at the same time.
Yeah. You answered beyond the answers, which of course I wouldn't expect any less from you. But I did put you as drawing your weapon because you're an aggressive kind of guy.
Okay.
So A, you draw a weapon. But just like many of these, there's two right answers sometimes, you know, and it's really situation dictates, just like in real life, correct? It's really dependent on what's going on. You're already outnumbered. You could literally pull a weapon and probably get away with saying, hey, I was outnumbered, I felt threatened, and so I pulled a knife or I pulled something to try and intimidate them back and create space or whatever, which leads to a little sidebar conversation. I'm curious your thoughts on this. And I went through this with John Lovell, Warrior Poet Society, right? And, you know, we are as military trained that if you pull your weapon, you better be pulling the trigger kind of mentality. But do you think there's a place to draw a weapon in order to prevent anything from going any further?
Absolutely. I mean, I tell guys that I used to say, don't pull your pistol out unless you're going to use it. Mm-hmm. And that was a very immature, less experienced
military
that said that. Yeah. Because cops pull their pistols out all the time and shoot people very rarely. Pulling out your pistol can have a very de-escalating effect.
Right.
Right. Yes. So what I tell guys is it's never posturing. It's never, I just want to win an argument. So I'm going to pull my pistol out. It is, okay, my 44 years of experience tell me that this is going to escalate. Therefore, I'm ready to shoot this guy if he takes two more steps forward. Therefore, if I can pull my pistol out now and say, no, buddy, let's just go ahead and stop right there. You know, if I can do that and he leaves, man, that's a much higher level win. It's always a higher level win to win with a lower level of violence.
Yes.
Right. Because I get to go home. He gets to go home. I'm not, even if it's a righteous shoot, that's still like I'm getting arrested that day.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there's still, I'm losing my pistol. Like there's going to be all sorts of anxiety because, you know, they're going to read you the riot act. They're probably still going to charge you with something initially. Like, man, everyone's life is better if you're like, no. Like, yeah. if you take two more steps forward, or it might be, you know, that same type of situation. Maybe one guy's got a pipe. You ID that. You pull a pistol out and you're like, no, man. Like, this is not happening. Go away. Go right. Home to mama right now. Like, go chill out at home. Like, I'm going to leave right now. But in your mind, you're like, if he comes around, if he breaks 12 o'clock on my truck, I'm going to burn him down. Because I can't, because past that, he's too fast for me to be able to engage him. And that is a significantly higher level win.
And I also think, too, you know, you mentioned the word basic a lot. And I think people forget that. Really, our job with any skill out there is you master the basics, then you will become advanced. It's not about showing up and learning some Jedi stuff. There is no Jedi stuff. It doesn't exist. It's so mastering the basics is what makes you a Jedi, right?
Man, I love that. That is perfect. That is exactly the key. Like I told people this for years. If you know, the secret to winning is simple. Master the fundamentals and then execute them faster than the bad guy.
Yeah,
that's it. That's right. All it takes.
We were supposed to stay at this like government building, but there was this like transition going on. So they wound up taking us to the new presidential palace, which was still being built. And it was one of those things where you walk in and they have all the president's photos lined up, but all of them are like 18 months in duration because they keep getting assassinated.
Yeah.
And you're like, okay, this isn't really great for instilling confidence. And they're still like painting the house. They're still like screwing in the light bulbs. And then I see these like two two or three like military convoys coming in, all these guys with like AK-47s. Like, what the? And they're like, this is my protection detail. That's going to help me with the delegation that's coming in. Plane lands the next day. I've got a pack of three. I've got the head of the organization, his number one, and a deputy. None of them are American. The only other two Americans are the pilots. But the airport, the private airfield, was attached to the presidential palace. So we've got this whole, like, three trucks of protection people. We're there for 3 days. First day, everything goes fine. Second day, I start to see the protection detail is like half of what it was. By the third day, it's 15 guys down from like 150. And I'm like, what's going on? We have a couple meetings scheduled for that day. And I get a ping from my guy at the embassy who's like, hey, when are you scheduled to leave? And I'm like, later this afternoon. He's like, no, leave now. Yeah. And I'm like, how much time do I have? And he just texted me back RFN, like right fucking now. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, shit. So I get the pilots to the plane, have them start ramping things up, get the number two to let the boss know that we've got to go. I just start filling a bathtub up with water to just destroy all the documents. I'm taking a nail and a hammer and just driving it through hard drives, throwing everything into the tub. Realize that there's an SUV in the garage that can get us to the plane. Fortunately, the keys were still in there and the driver was asleep. He would wake up in a storage closet a couple hours later, get everyone on the plane, or sorry, get everyone onto the SUV. We get to the plane, load it. And as we're ramping up, you see the military convoy coming through the gate. And wow. the same general that was like telling me how great his protection team was the one that was leading the coup. And I was like, hey man, drinks on you next time we're there. I was like, whew. Because the only Americans on that trip were the two pilots and me. Yeah. And I certainly did not want us to be bargaining chips in some new president's ascension to legitimacy.
And we got ambushed by one SKS, you know, wielding gunman from, he was in a fortified position. We were at tactical disadvantage with the early morning light going slightly uphill. They had a parapet dug where they were burying trash, but they had a really good overwatch position. They got one shot off. It went through both legs of my warden partner who I had trained in the academy about 6 months before that. Great young man. So he's bleeding out of four holes. And now we're in a gunfight where I'm engaging the guy that's coming around the corner that shot him and is trying to finish the job, while another sheriff's deputy is engaging a suspect that's got a sawed-off shotgun on me and another warden at 7 yards away through a canopy of brush and marijuana that we can't even see this bad guy. And before he's about to take a shot and take my head off, Snake, i.e. Deputy Craig Diver, took that guy out. And I wouldn't be talking to you, brother, if he didn't make that move. So, and that day, so we're working with three really dialed in sheriff's deputies, all military veterans, all on their SWAT and sniper teams. We had a little bit of that going on internally with us, and we had not really trained together adequately. We weren't compatible on radios yet. We didn't have all the stuff we needed. The trauma gear that you guys were getting really dialed in those mid 2000s over in the sandbox. But after that gunfight, shit changed quick. Mm-hmm. And essentially my partner survived that, but we kept him from bleeding out and he just held on by sheer will for 3 hours waiting for an air rescue.
What was probably the craziest thing you did?
Well, it would definitely be after September 11th doing those shipboarding operations. Like, I don't have to think too hard about that. My mind immediately went to bars and things like that. You know, as a new guy in platoon. But my second platoon was September 11th, and we were about 2 weeks into that second deployment. And we thought we were going to go right into Afghanistan, but instead we loaded up the plane in Guam. We flew in and ended up taking over the shipboarding operations for SEAL Team 3, and those guys ended up going into Afghanistan. But it was the only time during those 20 years that I got to do an actual real-world shipboarding operation, multiple. And what we would do is those ships would come out of Iraq, and because of the UN oil embargo, then they take a hard left-hand turn for Iranian waters. And if memory serves, you had about 20 minutes or so, depending on sea state and all the rest of it, to get on those things, take them over, turn them around back into international waters, and then turn them over to a prize crew, which are people that actually know how to drive big ships, which are like class three tankers loaded up with this oil. So it was interesting to do that because they put these passive countermeasures in place. And for people listening, a passive countermeasure would be something that is not directly like shooting at you. So they take barbed wire, string it up all over the deck. So if you tried to throw a fast rope out, it would get fouled. So you couldn't fast rope onto the deck. That meant you had to come in from the ocean, which meant that in these crazy sea states, it's a lot harder because they would always wait until it was they knew it was going to be very difficult for you in a small craft to come up alongside and board. And then if you did do that, then they cut the ladders off on all the these different levels. So instead of being able to scamper up, even once you're on board these things, scamper up to the next level, you couldn't do that because they were cut off. And then all the windows and doors were welded shut as well. So you have to get in there with an exothermic torch, with the saw, usually a combination of both, and get in there to take these things over. So you're on the clock to do this. Waters, you've got to get off that thing ASAP. And so that was pretty interesting. So as an enlisted guy, that was my first like real world type operation. So I would say that was probably the craziest thing I did as an enlisted guy, because it's like I would equate it to being a police officer, pulling somebody over in the middle of the night on the freeway or deserted highway, whatever. And you're walking up to it and you're not exactly sure who's in there, how many people are in there, what their mindset is. You're walking up on an unknown. So same thing here, middle of the night, rough sea state, you're getting on board and you're not exactly sure what you're going to find. So, so that was probably the craziest thing I did as an enlisted guy.
I've listened to your show, and I think actually your audience would really appreciate learning just a tiny bit about what it was like being a SEAL. Come on, give us a couple.
No, it was like, yeah, okay. My experience was pretty unique. It was cool. I got to, I went through Bud's class 203, which was in 96-ish, and then went to SEAL Team 3 and got to spend time at the NSA and then finished my career on the East Coast at Development Group, anyway, it was, I got lucky. I got to do the combat thing, but I also got to do more of the clandestine covert side of the house, pretty much an even split. And it's the last part of my career most people are interested in. Unfortunately, I can't really get into the details of it, but
all classified.
I what's funny is when I built the right kind of crazy, and I too used a little bit of the American Psycho kind of stuff to build the right kind of crazy, because I feel like that's what you need in order to, kind of go into special operations anyway. But, the beauty of it is the government redacted 100 pages. And that's a lot when you write a book. I mean, we had to basically do a complete rewrite once we got the manuscript back from the Pentagon, and they sat on that manuscript for a year. And then when we finally got it back, we were able to still turn it into something.
Is this 100 Deadly Skills?
No, that book, those books actually did really well. The Right Kind of Crazy, which I'm going to go and buy 100 Deadly Skills. Yeah, 100 Deadly Skills.
I can put them in my next movie, next Catherine Black sequel.
Dude, that would be awesome. I'll just send you some if you want them. But the book is great because it kind of tells you all this stuff, but then you see the redacted. I left all the redacted crap in there so that people could then kind of piecemeal, what I did later kind of together. But yeah, that's it in a nutshell. So there you go, listeners. At the request of Lewis Linton, we got some Clint stuff in there.
I love it. It's fascinating.
And as you know, I'm one of the idiots that likes to thread the needle and drive like an asshole in between cars. And I think that one of the most memorable moments with you, we had a government issued van, right? And we are in Hawaii, and I was kind of the designated driver for all the assholes. So it was like a 16 passenger government issued white van. And we get on Highway 1 in Hawaii, and I drive that thing like it's a Formula One car. And by the time we get done, which was very normal for me, it's just how I drove. And we get out of the van. I forgot where we were or what we were doing. You probably remember because your memory is like fucking 1,000 times better than mine. But I just remember you coming up to me and showing me your hand, and it had beads of sweat in it. And you're like, this is what your driving does to me.
In a van.
In a van, yeah. Did you say A-team?
A-team, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
They had to build something. Every episode, they had to build something at the end.
Yeah. And it's kind of like a little bit totally of MacGyver.
But it was fantastic, yeah.
Yeah. Let's do a little tribute here. One of my alarm features is definitely something.
Crack commando unit. Prison by a military court for a crime that he didn't commit. I can do the whole thing from memory.
Yeah. Yeah. As soldiers of fortune, if you have a problem, if no one else can help, and if you can find them, maybe you can hire the A team. Yeah. Still gives me goosebumps.
I tell you, I have the utmost respect for our military, all branches, and all the decisions that they have to make out in the field to save their own lives, their platoon, their comrades, and everybody that's with them, and also the decisions to protect our freedoms. It's huge, man. Man, I'm lucky. I get a roll cage and a helmet, and I get to go 200 miles an hour, and it doesn't hold a candle to what our military do. So thank you.
No, thank you, man. Thanks for your goodwill and supporting the troops the way you do. I know it's all appreciated. I was one of those guys that kind of brushed it off, like, you know, yeah, all right, support us, great, support us, don't, because the job was really, you know, at the forefront, and I had front sight focus at the time. But now that I've been out, guys like you making it happen for all the veterans, I think it makes a world of difference. So keep up the good deeds. And we sure appreciate you coming on the show, sharing your racing knowledge, your fiery, crazy situations, and of course, going through this scenario with us. We do appreciate it, and thank you.
No, it's my pleasure. No, it was a blast, you know, to jump in with you and to go through this process. That was great. And again, there's so much to learn about NASCAR. And this helps people see it from a different direction. So I'm happy to be a brand ambassador for not just Monster Energy, but for NASCAR.
Yeah, you are. You're a great symbol of the community. And like I always say, folks, keep it simple, because crisis will complicate the rest. And until next time, be safe out there. And for those of you listening, hey, keep it simple, because crisis will complicate the rest. And be safe out there until next time. Can You Survive This Podcast is a production of Calvary Audio and iHeartMedia. Recorded live from a secure location here in Dallas, Texas. Produced by Brandon Morgan, Jeff Apple, and Clint Emerson. Executive produced by Keegan Rosenberger and Dana Brunetti. For Calvary Audio, I'm Clint Emerson.